Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, April 30th. I'm your SunSounds volunteer, Jack Palmer, and I'll be reading international, national, and local news and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, "A Bill Would Limit Stays at ICE Holding Centers to 12 Hours," written by Daniel Gonzalez. After witnessing detainees packed like sardines during a surprise oversight visit to a short-term immigration holding facility in Mesa, Democratic House members from Arizona are introducing legislation to stop federal immigration authorities from holding detainees for longer than 12 hours at such facilities. The legislation, which faces an uphill battle in the Republican-controlled Congress, would restore a 12-hour cap on the amount of time immigration detainees awaiting deportation flights could be held at short-term holding facilities such as the one run by Immigration and Customs Enforcement at Mesa Gateway Airport. In addition to operating as a commercial airport, Mesa Gateway also serves as a major hub for federal deportation flights. Earlier in April, Democratic U.S. Representatives Greg Stanton, Yasmin Ansari, and Adelita Grijalva made a surprise nighttime oversight visit to a short-term ICE holding facility at Mesa Gateway. The three lawmakers said they discovered well over 250 detainees lying side by side on cement floors in severely overcrowded rooms, living in disgusting and horrific conditions with limited open-air toilets. The facility was designed for 157 people, and some of the detainees have been there for days waiting to be removed from the U.S. on deportation flights, the three lawmakers said in a news conference afterward. The bill, introduced April 28th, would restore an ICE standard that capped housing detainees in short-term holding facilities to no more than 12 hours, except in exceptional circumstances such as medical emergencies or transportation delays. The short-term cap was originally put in place because holding facilities such as the one in Mesa, called the Arizona Removal Operations Coordination Center, lacked beds, medical infrastructure, and basic accommodations for longer stays, according to the three lawmakers. In 2025, however, ICE issued a nationwide waiver allowing the agency to hold detainees for up to 72 hours in short-term holding facilities as part of the Trump administration's efforts to ramp up removals under a mass deportation campaign. Since then, as many as 777 detainees have been held at the ICE short-term holding facility in Mesa, according to federal data published by the Deportation Data Project at the University of California in Los Angeles and the University of California in Berkeley. From January 1st to March 8th of this year, the daily population at the facility has soared into the 500s and 600s and reached 777 on January 28th, the data shows. It's clear that overcrowding and overstaying the 12-hour time period for which the facility was built is standard operating procedure at this facility, and it's not acceptable, Stanton said in an interview. So this bill just says basically that a facility intended to hold detainees up to 12 hours should be 12 hours, not 3 or 4 days. Stanton said he opposes the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda, which has resulted in overcrowded conditions at short-term ICE holding facilities. but he hopes the proposed legislation limiting stays at short-term ICE holding facilities to 12 hours will attract support even from lawmakers who support the mass deportation agenda. Even if you support the mass deportation campaign, we should have a policy that you should use these facilities for the length of time and the purpose for which it was built, Stanton said. The proposed law would require the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, to ensure holding facilities provide humane conditions that are safe, clean, equipped with restroom facilities, and clear of any object that could be used as a weapon. The legislation also calls for ICE to provide detainees access to drinking water and a meal at least every 6 hours, and access to meals, snacks, milk, and juice to minors, pregnant women, and breastfeeding women, regardless of the length of stay. ICE and the Homeland Security Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Ansari said the legislation is intended to end the conditions she witnessed at the Mesa Gateway Airport short-term holding facility, which she called a display of disgusting cruelty. People are packed together like sardines in inhumane conditions and held far beyond the time these facilities are meant for, Ansari said in a statement. Our legislation places a 12-hour limit on short-term detention and brings transparency and accountability to these shocking facilities directed by President Donald Trump and Deputy White House Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, the architect of the Trump administration's immigration policies. Guiava said the bill restores common sense limits, strengthens oversight, and makes clear that humane treatment is not optional. It is the law. What we saw at AROCC wasn't just overcrowding. It was a failure of basic humanity, Guiava said in a written statement. No one should be forced to sleep on concrete floors or share a toilet in full view of dozens of others in confined spaces never meant for prolonged detention. The next article is titled, Louisiana's Voting Map Tossed by Court, written by Maureen Grope. The U.S. Supreme Court on April 29th threw out a congressional map in Louisiana that had been drawn to protect the voting power of black residents, a decision with implications for a landmark civil rights law. An ideologically divided court sided 6-3 with the Trump administration and with the non-black voters who challenged the map as relying too heavily on race to sort voters, and it did so just 3 years after upholding the 1965 Voting Rights Act's vote dilution protections for racial minorities. Writing for the conservative majority, Justice Samuel Alito called the map an unconstitutional gerrymander that violates the constitutional rights of the non-black voters who challenged it. The court's three liberal justices dissented. Justice Elena Kagan said the consequences of the majority's decision are likely to be far-reaching and grave, rendering the protections of the civil rights law all but a dead letter. The decision could ultimately reduce the number of black and Hispanic members of Congress and boost Republicans' chances of winning more seats in the U.S. House, where they have a thin majority. States now have a freer hand to change boundaries of voting districts at all levels of government. But the ruling, one of the most anticipated of the term, may not have been issued in time to make a significant difference in this year's midterm elections. A few states could try redrawing congressional maps, but would likely face both practical and legal challenges. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act tries to prevent legislative map drawers from diminishing the voting power of racial minorities by either packing them into one district or spreading them out across too many districts to have an impact. Those protections became more important after the court in 2013 struck down a different part of the act, one used to monitor states with a history of discrimination. It will now be easier for Republicans to draw maps that favor their party, particularly in the South, where a voter's race closely aligns with party preference. Alito wrote that the voting rights law requires evidence giving rise to a strong inference of intentional discrimination. In her dissent, Kagan wrote that intentional discrimination is very difficult to prove. That means, she said, that under the majority's new view of the law, a state can systematically dilute minority citizens' voting power without legal consequences. In Louisiana, the racially and politically charged case grew out of a years-long battle over the state's congressional map. After the 2020 census, the state legislature created a map that had only one majority black district out of six, even though black people make up about one-third of the state's population. When a group of black voters sued, lower courts said the map likely violated the Voting Rights Act, the centerpiece legislation of the civil rights movement passed after peaceful marchers were attacked by Alabama state troopers in what became known as Bloody Sunday. But in 2024, when the GOP-controlled legislature created a second majority black district, a group of self-described non-black voters went to court in a separate action, arguing a racial quota cost the state a Republican seat in narrowly divided Congress. The Supreme Court debated the issue in early 2025, but rather than issuing a decision, the justices took the rare step of calling for a second round of oral arguments that more squarely put the future of the redistricting protections in jeopardy. They asked whether states may create legislative districts that comply with the Voting Rights Act without violating the bans on racial discrimination in the 14th and 15th Amendments, changes to the Constitution passed after the Civil War to protect the rights of formerly enslaved people. Louisiana, which initially defended the map, argued instead in October that the Voting Rights Act's redistricting protections are both unworkable and unconstitutional. The Justice Department under President Donald Trump likewise argued that it's become too easy for courts to invalidate maps as discriminating against blacks without sufficiently considering whether race-neutral factors such as incumbency protection and partisan advantage played a role. The way Section 2 has been construed is so far from the things that are likely intentionally discriminatory and, indeed, are affirmatively compelling gerrymanders that are unconstitutional, Hashim Nupan, a Justice Department attorney, said during oral arguments. The attorney representing black voters in Louisiana countered, arguing the civil rights law has played a crucial role in diversifying leadership in the state and giving minority voters an equal opportunity to participate in the process. The next article is titled, Federal Judge Rejects Trump's Lawsuit to Get Arizona Voter Data, written by Ronald Hanson. A federal judge has dismissed the Trump administration's lawsuit seeking to require Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes to hand over the state's voter registration files, adding to a string of legal losses in other states. The April 28th ruling from the U.S. District Judge Susan Brnovich offered a swift end to an effort that has played out across the country, with White House seeking voter data to search for undocumented immigrants on state-managed rolls. The federal government has sued 30 states and already lost in at least five of them before the Arizona ruling, according to the State Democracy Research Initiative with the University of Wisconsin's Law School. In her 13-page order, Brnovich, who was named to the federal bench by President Donald Trump, said the U.S. Justice Department had failed to show it had a legal right to the data. This case presents a legal question. Is the Attorney General entitled to the statewide voter registration list? It does not present a political question. Should the Attorney General be entitled to the list? Brnovich wrote. The latter is reserved for the legislative and executive branches. Nonetheless, much of the briefing conflates these distinct inquiries, offering policy arguments in place of legal analysis. While such arguments may carry political weight, they are irrelevant to the court's limited task. Fontes, a Democrat, gleefully took to social media after the ruling. "Hey, folks, looks like your personal data is safe yet again because the case against me and the Department of Justice's illegal requests to grab that voter information data has been dismissed. The Department of Justice was wrong yet again in another state." In a joint statement with Fontes, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, said Brnovich rightfully dismissed the case, and they again said they would protect residents' private information, such as that in the voter database. That database contains the sensitive personal information of millions of Arizona voters, home addresses, dates of birth, and Social Security and driver's license numbers, they wrote. This is now the sixth federal court to reach the same conclusion. Arizona acted correctly in refusing this request, and today's ruling vindicates that decision. The U.S. Justice Department filed the case in January after months of letters between the government and Fontes had made clear he would not hand over data without a court order to do so. At the time, Fontes responded in a social media message that reflected his growing hostility with the Justice Department under Trump, telling the government to pound sand. The case instantly drew national attention because similar efforts have played out across the country. Several groups filed legal briefs siding with Fontes and the state of Arizona. Among those were 18 former lawyers from the Justice Department who worked in civil rights or election matters. Even though DOJ retains significant authority to investigate potential violations of federal election law, DOJ's request to Arizona for its full, unredacted voter file is inconsistent with prior DOJ practice and cannot be justified by the authorities it has invoked, the lawyers noted in their brief before the decision. DOJ has not provided any basis at all for thinking that Arizona might be violating federal statutes, much less a basis that would justify requesting sensitive voter data about all Arizona voters. Similar efforts in California, Oregon, Michigan, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island have already failed, the State Democracy Research Initiative reports. A case in Georgia was filed in the wrong court and was refiled. The state of Oklahoma reached an agreement with the government to share its voter files. The Arizona lawsuit is only one aspect of the federal government's election-related priorities. Federal agents have opened a criminal investigation that included sharing information from the Arizona State Senate's partisan and amateurish recount of Maricopa County's 2020 ballots. That investigation is presumably unaffected by Brnovich's ruling. The next article is titled, Arizona Woman Targeted and Harassed After Leaving a One-Star Review, written by Elena Santa Cruz. A Metro Phoenix business owner is accused of harassing a woman and calling the Department of Child Safety on her because she left a one-star review regarding his services. Frank Anthony Esquivel of Diamondback Security Cameras was arrested in April on suspicion of felony stalking after he reportedly sent anonymous messages to Victoria Valdez and taunted her about a year after she publicly shared her dissatisfaction with the job he did installing security cameras at her Tolson home, according to police records and an interview. Valdez, she learned about the investigation that she wasn't the first woman who had complained to police about Esquivel. Complaints have also been filed about the 59-year-old with the Arizona Registrar of Contractors, the state regulatory agency for contractor licensing. Two were filed over 5 years ago, while one was filed within the past year, according to the agency. Esquivel also lacks a contractor license, which the state requires, according to the agency. Esquivel installed Valdez's cameras in September 2024, but according to her, the process was not smooth. Weeks after the installation, Valdez said in a Google review that the installation took over a week because Esquivel kept canceling, refused to repair a hole he left in her ceiling, and left wiring exposed outside her house. The camera footage was also very pixelated and looked like the video game Minecraft, Valdez said, and Esquivel was rude, untruthful, and would scream. Esquivel fired back. He called her property a health hazard and said she should be lucky he even did the job. He claimed he had to throw away his clothes and said it was no wonder her neighbors hated her. She didn't respond and thought that was the end of it with Esquivel. Over a year later, a DCS employee reached out to Valdez, saying the agency received a complaint that her home was dirty and unlivable for her children. Their remarks were nearly verbatim of Esquivel's response to Valdez's online review, according to police records. DCS had to visit her home three times to interview Valdez's children, because not all of them were home during the first visit, according to police records. Throughout this time, Valdez received texts from an unknown number asking if she received a couple of visitors and asking how the visits went. "It was really creepy," Valdez told the Arizona Republic. After putting the pieces together, she said she figured it had to be Esquivel because of the similar verbiage between the DCS complaint and the response to her online review, and she felt he had access to her camera system, which would show when DCS left her home. "The only thing that I can think of is he's in my cameras," Valdez said. "How else would he know?" Valdez reported her issues with Esquivel to Phoenix police in November. Investigators spoke with the DCS caseworker and learned that everything was fine within Valdez's home, according to police records. The worker told police they were concerned for Valdez, who showed the worker the text messages she received. After obtaining permission, the DCS worker shared with investigators that Esquivel had submitted the complaint, according to police records. She told police Esquivel left her a message complaining that DCS was not keeping him updated about the status of the case against Valdez, police records said, and threatened to contact higher authorities if they did not share information with him. The caseworker told Esquivel that the case was closed in November, which he was not at all pleased with, according to police records. Valdez said a Phoenix detective told her there were multiple police filings against Esquivel for similar issues. Investigators also said in police records that he had a history of using fake phone numbers to harass women when he had an issue with them. While the case moved along, Esquivel sent another message to Valdez in February. "See, that's what happens." She didn't know what he meant by it. Esquivel was arrested on April 14th and, according to police records, told investigators that he called DCS on Valdez in retaliation for her online review. He also told police he sent her numerous messages, taunted her after each DCS visit, and left a message with DCS, according to the records. Valdez said the whole experience was scary for her family. She felt like a bad parent when DCS showing up, and because she believes Esquivel had access to her cameras, she felt like she was being constantly watched. "It's scary that something being used as protection is being weaponized by the very person who installed them," she said. Valdez said she wants to tear the cameras down, but she worries that might push Esquivel to escalate things further, or if he decides to show up at her house, she won't have video footage to prove it. "It's a catch-22," she said. Esquivel did not return phone calls or emails requesting comment. You're listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled "Congress Grills Hegseth on Iran War." Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth faced questions on the Iran war from Congress for the first time since the two-month conflict began, as President Donald Trump warned the Middle Eastern country to get smart soon and make a deal that meets U.S. demands. In his opening statement before the House Armed Services Committee, Hegseth celebrated the U.S. Armed Forces and blasted critics of the war as the military's biggest adversary. At the same hearing, Jules Hurst III, the Pentagon's acting controller, told the war in Iran has cost about $25 billion to date. Confronted by California Representative Salud Caballa about the estimated cost and how much more the United States plans to spend on the conflict in the future, Hegseth replied, "The question I would ask this committee is, what is it worth to ensure that Iran never gets a nuclear weapon?" Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, also pressed Hegseth on the economic cost of the war to American taxpayers. "You're saying that your operation is preventing a nuclear war. Will you acknowledge that there is an economic cost to the American people for doing what you believe is necessary?" Khanna asked, adding the war will increase costs by $5,000 for American households. The Pentagon's $25 billion estimate of the cost of the war was totally off, he said. "It's the incompetence," he added. Hegseth retorted that the cost of gas in Khanna's home state of California is twice as expensive due to horrible policy. Khanna shot back, "You said you wouldn't get into bad wars. You said you would bring down the prices." The comments came as talks between Washington and Tehran appeared at an impasse. Trump on April 29th told Axios he rejected Iran's latest proposal as it did not address U.S. concerns about its nuclear program. Earlier in the day, Trump in a social media post said, "Iran can't get their act together. They don't know how to sign a non-nuclear deal. They better get smart soon." Meanwhile, the two countries continue blocking shipping traffic in the Persian Gulf, raising global energy prices and surging gas prices to their highest level in 4 years. The price of oil surged to a four-week high early on April 29th, with Brent crude, the global standard, trading at $116, up 4%. Gas prices were also higher. One day after reaching a four-year high, AAA's national tracker on April 29th showed the average price for a gallon of regular unleaded was $4.23. At a separate budget meeting on April 29th, Pentagon controller Jules Hurst III told Congress the war in Iran has cost around $25 billion to date, with most going toward replenishing munitions and some toward operations and maintenance and movement of equipment. The Pentagon will also put together a supplemental request to Congress for more money to fund the war, Hurst said. Trump discussed a potential months-long extension of the blockade of Iranian ports during an April 28th meeting with energy executives, according to a White House official. Trump and the oil executives talked about steps that could be taken to alleviate global oil markets, already disrupted by the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, if the blockade is extended for months longer, according to the White House official who spoke on condition of anonymity. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent hosted the meeting, which was also attended by Vice President J.D. Vance and White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles. Which oil executives in attendance was not immediately clear. Meanwhile, Iranian officials said on April 28th the country would withstand the U.S. blockade as it was using alternative trade routes. Trump could soon face a hurdle to continuing the war in Iran. According to the War Powers Resolution of 1973, the president has 60 days after beginning a military conflict before he would potentially need approval from Congress to continue fighting. The countdown started when the president formally notified lawmakers March 2nd, meaning the deadline is May 1st. Further fighting after that date is expected to have Congress's sign-off, and a few Republicans have indicated they would not vote to continue fighting in Iran beyond that point. However, so far GOP lawmakers have shot down every Democratic effort to end the war. Trump could also give himself a 30-day extension to continue operations. Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun slammed Israel in a statement on April 28th, accusing the country of targeting non-combatants after Israeli airstrikes killed three Lebanese emergency response workers. President Aoun considered this attack to be added to a series of attacks that targeted relief and first aid workers, Aoun's office said in a statement. The strike indicates that Israel continues to violate international laws and conventions that protect civilians, paramedics, civil defense personnel, the Red Cross, and workers in the fields of rescue, first aid, and medicine. According to Aoun's office, the three civil defense personnel were killed while attempting a search and rescue mission connected with a different Israeli attack in southern Lebanon. USA Today has reached out to the State Department for comment. The United States Human Rights Office said in March that Israeli airstrikes on civilians in Lebanon may amount to war crimes. More than 2,500 people have been killed in Israeli strikes across Lebanon since March 2nd, when Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah fired on Israeli positions and triggered a widespread Israeli air and ground campaign. The next article is titled, Ex-FBI Director Faces DOJ Charges Again, written by Aisha Baghchi. Former FBI Director James Comey has been indicted for a second time after a judge dismissed an earlier indictment in November. A federal grand jury in North Carolina charged Comey April 28 with threatening to harm or kill President Donald Trump in an Instagram post in May 2025. The indictment also accuses Comey of disregarding a substantial risk that his post would be viewed as threatening violence. The Instagram post depicted an image of seashells reading 8647. Some Trump supporters interpreted the post as a threat because 86 is a slang term that means throw out or get rid of, according to Merriam-Webster, and Trump is the 47th U.S. president. Comey later deleted the post and said in a new one that he didn't realize some folks associate those numbers with violence, adding he took the post down because he opposes violence of any kind. Previously, the Trump administration pushed to prosecute Comey on allegations that he lied to Congress and obstructed a congressional proceeding, but the case was dismissed after a judge determined the prosecutor who brought it a former personal lawyer to Trump with no previous prosecutorial experience, was unlawfully appointed. The Justice Department has appealed that ruling. Both prosecutions have come after Trump specifically called for Comey to be criminally charged in September. Comey served as director of the FBI during the first Trump administration, before the president fired him in 2017. Well, they're back, this time about a picture of seashells on a North Carolina beach a year ago. And this won't be the end of it, Comey said in a video statement posted on his Substack April 28th. But nothing has changed for me. I'm still innocent, I'm still not afraid, and I still believe in the independent federal judiciary, so let's go, Comey added. Patrick Fitzgerald, a lawyer for Comey and former DOJ official, said in a statement his client vigorously denies the charges. We will contest these charges in the courtroom and look forward to vindicating Mr. Comey and the First Amendment, Fitzgerald said. At a press conference April 28th, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche argued that Comey's indictment isn't unique. Over the past year, this department has charged dozens of cases involving threats against all sorts of individuals. We take these seriously, every single one of them, Blanche said. However, Democrats and First Amendment advocates decried the charges as politically motivated and a threat to free speech. The term 86 has many possible meanings, including impeachment, and it's part of political discourse, Carl DeVries, a spokesperson at the Free Speech-Focused Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, said in a statement. DeVries noted conservative commentator Jack Prosobiec posted 8646 on Twitter in 2022, referring to then-President Joe Biden. Prosobiec rightly faced no criminal charges, DeVries said. The idea that Comey's picture of seashells conveyed a serious attempt to harm the president is ridiculous, DeVries said. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, alleged the Justice Department is seeking to appease the president with the new charges against Comey. Just like the last baseless indictment against Mr. Comey, this is another case of a weaponized Justice Department lashing out on behalf of a vengeful president, Durbin said in a statement. If you've missed any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. The next article is entitled, Dinner Witnesses Say Suspect Shot Secret Service Agent, written by Josh Meyer. A federal review of witness and agent statements about the April 25th shootout at the White House Correspondents' Association dinner is consistent with the suspected gunman being the one who shot a Secret Service agent, according to a law enforcement official briefed on the investigation. Evidence thus far indicates the only Secret Service agent who actually fired their weapon was the one who was injured as he tried to prevent what prosecutors say was an attempt to assassinate President Donald Trump and other administration officials. That agent, who has not been identified, fired five times while trying to stop suspect Cole Thomas Allen after he breached an initial security barrier at the event at the Washington Hilton Hotel, Acting General Todd Blanche said at an April 27th news briefing. The weapons of all the other Secret Service agents at the scene were checked and were never fired, according to the law enforcement source, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss an ongoing investigation that is being conducted by the FBI and Secret Service. The findings appear to undercut recent speculation by online observers who have pored over video of the shootout and saw numerous agents training their weapons on Allen from different angles. The law enforcement officials said that based on the information gathered to date, Secret Service officials have largely ruled out friendly fire as the cause of the agent's potential injuries, although we cautioned that an FBI ballistics and forensic investigation is still underway. When asked whose bullets hit the agent at a news conference April 27th, Blanche said, "We want to get that right, so we're still looking at it." Allen, Blanche told reporters, ran through the magnetometer holding a long gun. As he did so, Secret Service personnel assigned to the checkpoint heard a loud gunshot. One Secret Service officer was shot in the chest, but was wearing a ballistic vest that worked. This heroic officer, who was hit, fired five times at Allen, who was not shot, but fell to the ground and was promptly arrested, Blanche said. A check of Allen's shotgun showed that he discharged the weapon, Blanche said. The ballroom where the 2,500-person event was underway is one floor below where the incident occurred. MS Now reported April 26th that the FBI, which is the lead investigative agency on the shooting, had not found the bullet fragment that hit the Secret Service's officer's bulletproof vest, leaving investigators unable to say for certain whether the armed attacker shot the officer or how he was injured, citing two people briefed on the probe. The FBI is conducting its own investigation into the shooting to gather evidence about Allen, who was charged April 27th with attempting to assassinate the president. That probe includes not only the ballistics and forensic analysis to determine who shot the agent, but also whether the agent's discharge of his own weapon during the incident was done according to policy, the law enforcement official familiar with the investigations told USA Today. The next article is titled, "Beautiful British Day for King's Visit," written by Rebecca Moran. It was a very British day in the United States. King Charles III spent the second day of his four-day state visit tamping down concerns over the increasingly rocky relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. He delivered a rare and historic speech to a joint Congress, reaffirming that the two nations were, in fact, united. The state visit, the most consequential of Charles's reign, commemorates the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. It was the King's first U.S. trip since his 2023 coronation. The royals ended April 28th with a state dinner where Charles and President Donald Trump exchanged toasts. Redcoats took over the White House lawn, but it was the president's own United States Marine Band wearing red jackets welcoming Charles and Queen Camilla to the White House. The White House embraced some British traditions and highlighted English icons, and even Mother Nature brought a London-esque overcast to Charles and Camilla's visit. "What a beautiful British day this is," Trump said in opening remarks on the damp lawn, gray clouds luring overhead. U.S. flags and the Union Jack lined the steps leading to the portico balcony of the White House. The pastries the White House put out for an educational event on AI, attended by First Lady Melania Trump and Camilla, included cheddar cheese and sweet pepper sandwiches, lemon madeleines and scones, titled Queen's Drop Scones. The First Lady and Queen walked around a tennis pavilion on the White House grounds to meet with students for the event. While some students tested virtual reality headsets, others looked at glass-enclosed plates and statues, including a bust of former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. They also gazed at a painting of former President John Adams, who was the first U.S. ambassador to Great Britain. Typically, when a leader addresses Congress, it's the President of the United States who often proclaims, "The State of the Union is strong." The United States and the United Kingdom are at odds over a range of issues, from Trump's ongoing tariff war, his insults against NATO, and the ongoing war in Iran, to name a few. But the king said the bond between his country and the United States remains strong. "Ours is a partnership born out of dispute, but no less strong for it," Charles said. "Our nations are in fact instinctively like-minded, a product of the common democratic, legal, and social traditions in which our governance is rooted to this day. Drawing on these values and traditions time and again, our two countries have always found ways to come together." Charles' speech was sprinkled with jokes that landed well among lawmakers. There were notable party divides in applause and standing ovations. Democrats cheered Charles's remarks, stressing the importance of the NATO alliance and protecting the environment. Republicans were rowdier when the king highlighted his Christian faith. A major point of contention in recent weeks between the United States and the United Kingdom: the war with Iran. Charles notably did not mention the war in Iran by name in his speech to Congress. The United Kingdom has said it does not want to be involved in the war. Instead, he voiced support as a Christian for interfaith relationships. "Having devoted a large part of my life to interfaith relationships and greater understanding, it is that faith in the triumph of light over darkness which I have found confirmed countless times," the king said to applause. "It is why my hope, my prayer, that in these turbulent times, working together and with our international partners, we can stem the beating of plowshares into swords." But Charles did mention one country at war that needs help: Ukraine. He called for continued mutual support for its defense. "The same unyielding resolve the two nations showed in fighting terrorism after September 11, 2001, is needed for the defense of Ukraine and her most courageous people," he said before being interrupted by applause. It is needed in order to secure a truly just and lasting peace. Though Charles did not specify Iran policy in his speech, Trump, during his toast, said the king agreed that Iran should not have a nuclear weapon. "We're doing a little Middle East work right now. We're doing very well. We have militarily defeated that particular opponent, and we're never going to let that opponent ever," Charles agrees with me even more than I do, "we're never going to let that opponent have a nuclear weapon," he said. The state dinner was a white tie affair, tuxedos with tailcoats and floor-length gowns. Bouquets of lilac, butterfly ranunculus, phlox, and lily of the valley filled the center of the tables like a garland. A tall candelabra set the mood. Tables were set for 250 pieces of vermeil from the White House collection, in addition to handcrafted ceramics by distinguished American artists, including Ben Wolfe. The White House served Dover sole meunière as the main course. For dessert, a chocolate gâteau shaped like a beehive. Guests included some of the United States' leading tech giants, such as Apple CEO Tim Cook and Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, plus all the conservative justices on the Supreme Court. Even athletes received invites. Golfer Rory McIlroy of Northern Ireland and New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. The next article is entitled, "Trump Holds Talks on Prolonged Iran Blockade," written by Timothy Gardner. President Donald Trump discussed how to mitigate the impact of a potential months-long U.S. blockade of Iran's ports with oil companies, a White House official said on April 29th, as he urged Tehran to get smart soon and sign a deal. The April 28th talks with oil executives followed a deadlock in efforts to resolve the conflict, which has led the United States to try to squeeze Iran's oil exports with a naval blockade aimed at forcing it to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to shipping. While Washington and Tehran traded public threats, mediator Pakistan was trying to avoid escalation while the two sides continue to exchange messages on a potential deal, a Pakistani source told Reuters on April 29th. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.